Welcome to the third session in our series, Finding New Life on the Other Side of Loss. This week and next week, we're going to talk about coping with loss of friends and loved ones, be it by death or by estrangement. And we are very fortunate to have Dr. Jack Opperle lead us in these two sessions. He has many, many years of experience as a Methodist pastor and as a teacher at St. Vincent College. He knows all ages, and I think he's probably seen about as many experiences as we can imagine. And we want to thank him especially for stepping in for Louise Rogers, who's gone on to a new job at the Presbytery. And she was slated to do these 2 weeks, and Jack graciously agreed to do them. So thank you, Jack, and we'll let you open with prayer.
Thank you, Sarah. So nice to be with you this morning. Hello to all of you who are in the chapel and to those of you who are with us on Zoom. And before we begin our time together, let us bow in an acknowledgement of our commitment to God in Christ as we pray. Let us pray. Holy and abiding God, we give you thanks for the wonder of your mercy in our lives. For we are mindful that always that mercy is uplifting. It is renewing. It grants us perspective, and it allows us to traverse what we never thought we would find. As we are together around these weeks, looking at the issues of loss, be with us and grant to us not only a sense of perspective, but also that sense of empathy, which reaches out to touch the lives in need. Lord God, for this fellowship, we give you thanks through Christ our Lord. Amen. So we're ready to fly, I guess. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. All set. Good. A couple of comments about being here today. First of all, I was delighted when Ted and Sarah reached out several weeks ago and invited me to come and be a part of this experience for these next 2 weeks. I have to say I was just a little bit offended. And that is, I was invited to come to these two sessions as a substitute. So I'm here sort of on loan. And you know, it's kind of hard on the ego. You like to be billed as the very first choice. The second thing is that Ted shared with me that perhaps the first two had been a bit more academic than they were expecting the second two to be. And I didn't quite know what that meant. But one of my students helped me to understand that at the close of the last semester, I taught a course in Buddhism, which this young man had taken, and incidentally had done very well and was very bright, very capable, good questions, good comments, and a great sense of humor. And on the last session of the class, he said, hey, Doc, I'd like to make a comment. Okay. He said, this has really been a great course. He said, it's really opened my eyes to the diversity of religions in the world, cultures, of how it is that we are more alike than we are different. But he said, I would like to make one comment. He said, I hope that if the theology department of St. Vincent College ever decides to do this course again, that they will find someone other than some senile old man to teach it. So today I'm sort of here as the non-academician in a sense. What I have prepared, seriously, is to take a look at two outstanding figures of the last century. The first is Ann Kubler-Ross, the psychiatrist, author, and person who cared about folks who were going through the experience of loss by way of death, and ultimately, people who were going through change and loss in a variety of ways. Ann Kubler-Ross is best known for her marvelous book written in 1969 on death and dying. But what most people don't understand is that Kubler-Ross was also involved in work dealing with the hospice development in America and across the world. She was terribly involved in mental health. She had a concern for children And yes, she was involved with AIDS patients who were left to die oftentimes very much alone. Ann Kubler-Ross was a psychiatrist by training. She earned her medical degree from the University of Zurich in Switzerland, her home country. Ultimately came to the Manhattan State Hospital in New York City, and there she became a part of a staff pursuing her degree, her specialization in psychiatry. While she was there, Ann Kubler-Ross made a somewhat alarming discovery. And that discovery said that oftentimes patients who were suffering from psychiatric disorders, who also had some sort of a terminal illness, were often treated differently than those who were not sick. And what she discovered was that psychiatric patients with terminal illness, those people who were going to die, were oftentimes not given the same kinds of care and appropriate attention as were others. And that really prompted the beginning of her work. As people have read on death and dying, and looked at the five stages that we're going to talk about this morning, most people have made a great error. Number one, they have assumed that each stage is somehow definitive, that everything that is to be known about denial or grieving or acceptance is contained in the chapter dealing with that specific issue in her book. That is not true. From the very beginning, Ann Kubler-Ross made it clear that her work was not definitive. It was ongoing. Secondly, as is true with books of this kind, oftentimes people misread the intentionality of it. And therefore, lots of people believed that they would move through these various five steps sequentially, building 2 on 1, 3 on 2, 4 on 3, and 5 on 4. And of course, many of them discovered that is not the way the grieving or dying process works, but rather it is much more of a dynamic fluidity kind of experience. And so she had to write a kind of an addendum in which she told her readers about the fact that these terms are just that and are constantly being revisited and redefined. And that secondly, they are not sequential. And then perhaps the most important thing of all, in the last pages of her second addendum, she writes that her intention for writing the first book on death and dying had to do with her hope that her work would create a conversation about death, dying, and change, which had been a taboo up until that point. Think about it. She's got a valid point. Think of how difficult it is for people to make out a will. Think of how challenging it is for people to come up with a medical directive. Think of how difficult it is for people to make their funeral arrangements. And think of how seldom we talk about those issues. And when we talk about grieving and change, not much changes. We don't like change. We shy away from grieving. And as Harold Kushner in his book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, has written, in the midst of my pain of grieving, I had no one to talk to. Think about that. In the midst of my grieving, and by the way, his grieving was tied to the death of his 14-year-old son, who died at 14 as a patient of an advanced aging disorder. And so when we look at Ann Kubler-Ross's work and her legacy, I want you to keep in mind that these terms are not offered as somehow being all-knowing. And certainly they're not sequential. And here's the best part. Yes, you're right. The book began by addressing the question of what I do whenever I face my death. However, It also then moved to, what do I do? When I experience the grieving of a parent's death or a child's death or a close friend's death. We had that experience in our home this past couple of weeks. The dentist to which we have been going was a great guy. Positive, very competent in his profession, easy to talk to, open to questions, just a fine fellow. A week ago Tuesday, we discovered that he had committed suicide and was dead in his office. I need to tell you this morning that that really impacted Barbara and me. It left us with a sense of loss that was profound, not only in terms of losing a professional in our lives, but a person who stood at the very heights of life, and beyond that, who perished in such a sad and, a very sad manner. So grieving soon became a part of the book on death and dying. And here's also something that's pretty interesting. Within 6 years of its publication, the majority of 500 Fortune companies in America were using it as a basis for addressing the changes that occur in the corporate world, moving up or moving down, or then again, as we've recently seen in the tech numbers, moving out. In fact, the book has been now called The Kubler-Ross Change Curve, in that they are using it to help people through those transitions. And so, what are the five stages that Kubler-Ross talks about? Here's the first one. It's called denial. It can be applied to the reality of one's own terminality, or then again, it can also be tied to the moments of life when we lose someone that we love. What does she write about denial? Number one, she says it's normal. Isn't that important to hear? So oftentimes when we talk about the most intimate structures of life, we tend to think that we're abnormal, that we're the only person to ever face such a reality. We're the only one going through it. And certainly that's true with change. We joke about it because we're afraid to really talk about it. Denial is absolutely normal whenever the report comes back, no treatment. Denial is absolutely normal whenever we lose a spouse, a parent, a child, a friend, a dentist. Denial is absolutely normal whenever we're told your job has been eliminated and you learn that you are one among 3,000 others, thus restricting the numbers of opportunity that are available. Denial is normal, she writes. Number two, she also writes that sometimes denial is obviously extremely overt, very targeted, very clear. Denial has to do with making some attempt to blame our situation on someone else. However, denial can also be very internal. It can be something that we very much try to hide or shadow or keep from other people from knowing. It's not always an overt saying, you're wrong. Sometimes it's a way of acting, a way of denying that many people don't even see. Three, why do people deny? Well, one reason she offers is this: they're looking for a more desirable alternative, even though it's unrealistic, even though it may never happen, even though ultimately it will be proved errant. In the moment of discovery, denial wishes for something to occur, even though it's unrealistic, because it is somewhat better. Kubler-Ross writes in the section dealing with denial that regardless of whether or not it is accepted as abnormal or normal, whether or not it is targeted or more subtle, whether or not it is realistic or mythological. Ultimately, denial must be addressed because the outcome it offers is not one that is helpful. And she writes that denial can be addressed by getting good information, by talking to others about our issues, and by discovering what is a reasonable, realistic approach. Denial is the first stage of Ann Kubler-Ross's understanding of terminality. Here's the second. It deals with the concept of anger. Once again, she writes that anger is a very, very complex emotion. Sometimes it is terribly specific. We're angry with the doctor. We're angry at the diagnosis. We could be angry at the family member who has died. We could be angry with the executive who has terminated our position. Anger can be extremely specific, and when it is, it's usually directed in a way that is extremely clear. Anger is not something that just stands on the sidelines of life and wonders. It can be very specific, and it also can become terribly generalized. After a while, people are just plain angry. I think we all know something about that. I certainly do. There are moments in life that occur for most of us in which we're just angry. We may be able to articulate specific people or specific situations or particular issues. However, the overriding reality is that there is an anger that is a part of our existence. She writes that anger is ultimately fatal. Anger ultimately destroys us. Anger keeps us from gaining perspective. And anger will give you an outcome that is probably or perhaps even more painful than the issue itself. She illustrates that by talking about when we grieve the loss of a loved one. And when we get angry about that, what are some of the things that she talks about we do? Well, sometimes people take down pictures of the loved one who's gone. Here's something else they do. They often discard clothing and other kinds of personal belongings. Or they stop talking about the individual. They're angry. And they make choices that are terribly sad. And in terms of a long-term outcome, are usually more painful than the original loss itself. Anger is the second stage that Ann Kubler-Ross addresses in terms of death, dying, and loss. Three, she then talks about the issue of bargaining. This is something that is terribly difficult to define. Probably if you're going to put out a questionnaire and you're going to ask people, have you ever bargained for your life? Most people will say no. It's a very subtle kind of thing because it is an attempt to make something that is terribly unrealistic, realistic. It's something that is unrealizable, irrational, that we try to make rational. If the tumor goes away, I will do this. If the headaches stop, I will start doing that. Bargaining is an attempt to pursue a solution that does not really address the fundamental problem. In 1969, Ann Kubler-Ross said, it's sort of like rubbing some sort of a snake oil on a tumor. The chances are it's not going to work. But bargaining nevertheless buys the snake oil and reads carefully the directions. Number four, she talks about the reality of depression. And I think this is terribly relevant for the age in which we're living. I've been noticing in the news media more and more discussions about the reality of depression in our culture. And most of those discussions link that to the pandemic. They talk about the fact that depression increased during the pandemic because we couldn't go out to dinner and we couldn't go to the movies. Or then again, we got sick. Or then again, someone we loved got sick. However, I have a suspicion that the underlying issue of depression is much more than our experiences in the pandemic. I think it is a part of our culture. It's a part of living. It's a part of reality. And as Kubler-Ross talks about depression, she says that depression associated with loss, grieving, and death is classical. What does that mean? It means that we feel immobilized, unable to act, to do anything. It means that we're sad. This should not have happened. It means that we feel remorse and isolation. We're sick. It means fatigue, in that getting out of bed, going through a day, going to the oncology appointments, getting the blood tests, dealing with the x-rays, after a while, become unbearable. Depression is real. And it seems to me that when we talk about Ann Kubler-Ross's work and life, it's interesting to me that we have missed the fact that she understood that. She did not treat AIDS patients from a point of view of dealing with their symptoms. She dealt with AIDS patients because they had been isolated and were filled with a sense of despair. She dealt with dying children because of the families that were losing them. This woman understood the issue of depression. So far, so not so upbeat, is it? So far, it's kind of depressing, kind of sad. However, she ends with this note. She writes that as we deal with all of those interchanging, ever-changing dynamics of those first four notions, denial, anger, bargaining, and depression, if we can find a way to deal with them significantly, at last we will live in the land she calls acceptance. Acceptance is not resignation. It is not saying, well, there's nothing left to do. Acceptance has to do with understanding that perhaps there are some options that we can still exercise. Acceptance understands that perhaps there are some alternatives about which we can have discussion and make choices. It's a sense of reality which offers options and enhancement to the experiences of life. And she is very clear in her book that the reality of death, our death, the reality of grieving, our grieving, the reality of change and loss, our change and loss, when we accept that, once again, it is not giving up, it is not surrender, but rather it is becoming willing to be open to options, alternatives, decisions, choices that may bring some sense of enhancement to the death, the grieving, and the loss we are experiencing. Ann Kubler-Ross's book on death and dying was followed by 20 others. It became the foundation for the conversation that did enhance the meaning of the hospice program in America. It caused her to take a strong position against euthanasia, and the reason she took it is very interesting. She said euthanasia perhaps prevents a person from moving through the stages of life that ultimately allow for the enhancement of alternatives that acceptance provides. Ann Kubler-Ross's work was dedicated to caring for AIDS patients, for children, for mental people, mental patients who had been forgotten. Now, what I'd like to do this morning is to link those five categories that Kubler-Ross offers to us as a means by which to deal with the question of loss. I'd like to link those to a man whose name is Paul Tillich. Paul Tillich was an outstanding theologian of the 20th century. He is often called the theologian's theologian. He was born in Germany. He survived the First World War. He survived the issue of Nazism in his native country. He was a teacher. He was a man of great dramatic abilities. But listen to this. He was a man who was haunted by death. That sense of haunting began for Paul Tillich during the First World War. He was a chaplain. And in that war, that did not mean that he simply held church services. It meant that he was part of the group that gathered up the bodies of the dead or the parts of the dead and then buried them. And after a while, that kind of an experience, that kind of a ministry, that kind of exposure to loss overcame Paul Tillich. And he writes in his book, The Courage to Be, about many of the same concepts that Ann Kubler-Ross describes. He uses some different words, to be sure. He talks about his anxiety. He talks about his deep sense of despair. He talks about his sense of losing everything that mattered. He talks about not being able to respond to the issues of his life because he was literally unable to identify them. So what did Paul Tillich do? In that same book, Courage to Be, I find it interesting as he discusses his strategy. Number one, Paul Tillich was a good German Lutheran. He had been ordained into the clergy of the German Lutheran Church. Before him, his father and grandfather had been preachers in that church. And yet, Paul Tillich turned to Catholicism as he struggled with his demons. He writes that he turned to Catholicism because of its structure, because of its willingness to identify and define moments of life. He talks about the sacraments of the Catholic Church as addressing the moments of life in which everything is at stake. Think about it. Baptism, the moment of birth. It's a joyous moment to be sure, but it brings with it all of those unknowns, all of those futures, all of those questions, and maybe even some of those disappointments. Think about this, the sacrament of Holy Communion, oftentimes the first exposure that we have to the meaning of faith. And suddenly we discover we're not so sure as to what faith is. How about marriage? The concept of marriage, I think, is greatly, greatly dramatized. We think of marriages as what happens in churches. We think of beautiful cathedrals. We think of beautiful people walking down the aisle. Everybody's dressed up. Everything's going to be fine. And then it isn't. And of course, the Catholic Church deals with the concept of the last rites, the ministry to the sick, acknowledging that all of us will die. He found in the structure of Catholicism something to keep him on the rails, something that gave him guidance when he had none at all from himself. Number two, he also turned to the meaning of culture. Now, when you talk about culture in Paul Tillich's scheme, you're talking about the diversity that we experience every day in our lives. One of the neat things about teaching is that you are forced to deal with the diversity of our society. There's racial diversity, there's theological diversity, there's gender diversity, there's sexual preference diversity, there's home background diversity, and there they all sit. And your job, your responsibility, and also I might add, your privilege, is to teach them something. And what I have discovered, that as one interacts with students in that context, their diversity is sometimes much more instructive than anything I have to offer. Paul Tillich became open to the wonder of diversity. And what that meant was theology was larger than the German Lutheran Church. Number three, he also turned to the creativity of art. The creativity of art. As Paul Tillich looked at the great art in the great cathedrals and the great museums of Europe, this is what he thought about. He thought about the moment when those canvases were blank and how it was that someone, somewhere, somehow created the Mona Lisa, the Sistine Chapel, creativity. Lastly, he talks about the magnificence of literature and drama's emotions. That is to say, the feelings that we have as we make our way through whatever pilgrimage is ours. And so Paul Tillich moved from a young man returning from the First World War broken. He suffered a nervous breakdown. He was unable to grasp anything. Why? Because the world he had known had changed. Loss was real. Grieving was a part of his sleep. And death was real. And as he utilized all of those tools in an attempt to find his way back to some degree of normalcy and hope and health, he developed what he called the doctrine of correlation. The doctrine of correlation. The doctrine of correlation has three very, very academic sounding terms. I'm going to use them, and then I'm going to try to define them. The first term in the doctrine of correlation, the doctrine of correlation is that, how do you utilize structure, creativity, emotion, diversity? How do you handle those realities in such a fashion so as to get to what Ann Kubler-Rice calls acceptance of loss? First term, it's called heteronomy. Don't worry about spelling it, heteronomy. What in the world does that term mean? Well, Tillich is pretty clear. Heteronomy suggests to us that as we deal with all of the emotions of change and loss and death and grieving and all of the structures associated with them, there are all kinds of people around who are prepared to tell us how to handle that. There are sources that are constantly in our lives in this concept of heteronomy who assume that we're children. And so as we cross the street of making a decision, figuratively, what they do is take our hand and say, come, I'll show you how to do this. As we experience our death, as we experience the death of a spouse, a friend, a colleague, as we deal with loss, there's always someone who's able to give us the perfect working definition of what to do next. Now, for Paul Tillich, that source could be any number of options. Number one, it could be a family member, an overprotective parent, an overly aggressive child, a spouse that knows everything. Or then again, maybe it could be a friend. We all have one who knows exactly what we need to do in order to address a moment. Or sometimes it's a religious or a medical professional. They sit in an office and they tell us what we're supposed to feel and how we're supposed to handle that. Sometimes in Tillich's world, we even assign to God that source of all knowingness. And so in our prayers and in our believing and in our faith, we somehow think God is going to make the difference. That became very personal for me many, many years ago during my mother's fight with cancer and death. She did pretty well across the first several years, but in the last months, I noticed a change. And one afternoon, as I went into her room to spend some time with her, I noticed that the change was really significant. And so after some conversation, it finally came out. My mom had been a pretty faithful believer. My mom was the kind of a person who prayed, who read the Bible, who believed. And she shared with me how it was that she felt that somehow her faith had been errant. And so I pursued that with her, and this is what she told me. She told me that just before I had arrived, her minister had been there. And this is what he told her. Ethel, if you just pray hard enough, you'll be healed. My mother was praying pretty hard. We all were. And she died. You see what heteronomy can do? It comes from those who know everything, but know nothing about us. No matter the source of that kind of information, it takes from us the options of life. Here's the second phrase that Tillich would use. It is the word autonomy. Think of heteronomy as childhood. Think of autonomy as rebellious teenage years, adolescence. Think of it as rebellion, defiance, insistence upon doing everything my own way. And we all know from our own personal experience, or then again dealing with an adolescent, that sometimes those kinds of choices can become very reckless. And they create far more pain and regret than we can handle. Sometimes the outcomes of an adolescent response, "I'll do it my way," produce moments down the road described by these kinds of words. "I wish I had known a little more about this. I wish I had done it differently." Paul Tillich, in Courage to Be, writes, "Adolescence is not something that is defined purely by the number of years we have lived. Adolescence has to do with the attitudes that we bring to the issues of our lives. And when we use the adolescent approach, 'I'll do it my way, I know everything about this, I don't care what you think,' there's a real good chance we're going to create an outcome, a moment that is fraught with disaster. Autonomy. It's something to be concerned about. There's a third term, the third of three. It's called theonomy. Theonomy. Now, obviously, for Paul Tillich, a theologian, the word theonomy relates to his understanding of God. However, the essence of God that he refers to is something that Tillich also understood could be expressed in a countless number of ways. You see, Paul Tillich understood God not in the fixed dynamics that so many of us do, whether it be gender, God our Father, whether it be God eternal, whether it be God of love, it doesn't matter. For Paul Tillich, God was more than all of our definitions, and therefore God could be found in a variety of ways. God could be that friend. God could be that family member. God could be the experience of our faith tradition. God comes in many ways, writes Tillich. Tillich got into a little trouble with religionists because in one of his systematic works, he made these statements. God does not exist. What he meant by that was, God does not exist in the contexts and in the labels that we create for God. Tillich writes, God is existence. And what that means is that regardless of the vehicle by which the message comes, it originates in the wonder of God's positive energy that wishes for us to have abundance, alternatives, choices, outcomes that have meaning. Beyond that, purpose. Theotomy suggests to us that we can discover something inside of us that has clearly come from beyond us and offers to us all sorts of alternatives, enhancements, and possibilities as we experience the many definitions of life. Now, if you're not too asleep already, let's go a step further. Let's try to just anticipate how these three concepts of the doctrine of correlation, remember what they were? Heteronomy, somebody telling you what to do. Autonomy, I'll do it my own way. Three, theonomy, something in us that comes from beyond us. How do those concepts relate to the concepts of Ann Kubler-Ross? Well, when we talk about denial, this is what heteronomy says. Don't worry, this will pass. Heteronomy says, everybody gets that. Heteronomy says, you'll be fine. Heteronomy says, how about this one? Be strong. Harold Kushner, his wonderful book, by the way, I recommend it to you, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Harold Kushner writes about, as I said earlier, the death of his 14-year-old son. And he includes in that writing how it was that many of his friends, as they arrived to pay their respects, would say this to him. Harold, this experience will make you stronger. Harold's response to that was, already, I am strong enough. Heteronomy helps us to participate in denial in a way that is denial. What does autonomy do? It says, well, I'm not going to take the medicine. Or then again, give me more. Autonomy says the way out of this is for me to get involved in some sort of mythological concepts. Autonomy says, I can handle this all by myself. I need no help. And we all know where that kind of thinking ultimately resides. Autonomy produces an outcome relevant to denial that is tragic. And therefore, what about theonomy? Well, Paul Tillich came back from the First World War a broken man. In his experience of Catholicism and art and creativity and diversity of culture, he found his way toward dealing with denial in a manner that was significant. And so, while he talked often about death, his death, and the reality of dying, in 1965, when Paul Tillich died, his wife, Hannah, their two children, a group of friends gathered in the chapel at the University of Chicago where he was teaching, and they celebrated his life. They were able to do that because before his death, Paul Tillich celebrated those same kinds of reality, affirming these words, God is present. What does Paul Tillich's concept have to say about the notion of anger? Well, in Tillich's world, anger, bargaining, and depression all fall within the same category, which he called anxiety, for the German word angst. The German word angst is much more descriptive than the English word anxiety. Let me give you a couple of definitions. Number one, the Germans using the word angst refer to something that is unnamed. They also refer to something that is undefined. They define angst as something that haunts us. They ultimately define angst as something that cripples us and keep us from meaning. For Paul Tillich, as we deal with anger, bargaining, and depression through the vehicle of heteronomy, we deal with a kind of an indifference that refuses to name, define, or accept. As we deal with autonomy, we say, I'll deal with all by myself. I don't need any more help. Oh, I don't even have a problem. But as we deal with theonomy, Tillich writes that our anger, our bargaining, and our depression are seen for what they are, unnamed, undefined, haunting. And therefore, we discover that we are loved unconditionally, that we are accepted in grace, that we are affirmed in spite of our frailties. We are able to accept who we are and what we are. The doctrine of correlation with these three terms gives to the person who is facing death some doors that they can open that are called alternatives. There's more than one way to deal with that circumstance. Two, it allows for us an experience of something that is more than academics. It is actual life experience. It is not something that lives in the classroom. It is something that lives in the hospital room, the living room, or how about the courtroom, or how about the chapel? It is something that we face in the company of others as over and against walking alone. It's not simple. It's not dynamic, but it is doable. And so I think I'm going to stop there and maybe entertain some questions. I'm going to certainly some questions, some options other than the ones I've looked at, or then again, some notions that, you know, it really doesn't make any sense. I think we have some time. I have about 25 of. Yeah. So anybody want to pop in here?
I want to invite folks who are online, if you want to unmute and ask a question, just to jump right in. And then anybody in the chapel? So I'll have a question for you, Jack. And that is, can you comment on heteronomy from the perspective of someone who wants to be with a person who is facing grief? You gave the example of that person not being comfortable with the grief that another person is facing.
I don't think it's easy to be around death. And have you noticed that when we get around moments of life that cause us some degree of uneasiness, we often reach into our bag of tricks that isn't particularly helpful. I don't offer this illustration to be humorous. That's not my point. But I've noticed, mostly as someone grieving, that when people arrive at a funeral home or a chapel for the public viewing, they often say things that I think are well-intentioned, but are not helpful. They might even be a little cliche-ish. And I think that grows up out of the fact that it's hard to know what to say. Next week, I'm going to utilize three distinct stories. Number one, I'm going to talk about a friend, a man who is facing his own death. Two, I'm going to talk about a little child who was struck and killed on a highway and how her family struggled with that death. Thirdly, I'm going to talk about a pastor who went through loss and what it meant to have someone be supportive and helpful of him. And I think a theme you're going to find running throughout all of those illustrations and stories, and they're all true, but they're stories, what you're going to discover is, in every circumstance, those people were both helped by individuals who had done the hard work of thinking about what do you say, what do you offer, including every now and then, one of the great things you can offer is silence, saying nothing, grasping a hand, sharing an embrace. The last thing I think you want to say is, I understand, because you may not. So I think the heteronomy is that, as I described it in Tillich's idea, is plagued by that kind of anxiety. They feel they have to say something. They feel they have to do something, and it's not always helpful. How do we change that? I think that's what Kubler-Ross is all about. She makes it very clear that her primary purpose was to create a conversation about these issues of death and grieving and loss before they happen, so that when they do happen, there is a sense of comfort's the wrong word, which I think you understand what I mean. There's a sense that we've been here before and that we've given it some thought. As a pastor, I think one of the most rewarding and yet challenging experiences is to do a memorial service, a funeral service, and do it in a way that, number one, is personal without being maudlin, and number two, that is helpful, and make sure that it is not hurtful. It's a real challenge, and I can truthfully say to you that over the 40 years that I was privileged to be that person, that pastor, it wasn't that doing a funeral or a memorial service was hard. That's not the point. It's not about me. The point is, it required a lot of thought and a lot of prayer and a lot of awareness. It meant knowing. Let me illustrate that. We had a dear friend who died, and his widow asked me to come and give the eulogy. Their pastor was not at all happy about that. Kind of it perceived that as something of a rebuff or certainly an intrusion on my part. The deceased's name was Frank. And then on the day of the funeral, as we gathered and as the pastor stood to call the congregation in a sense to order, he said, "We have come here today to remember and give thanks for our dear friend, Fred." Not a good thing. I don't know if that gets to your question, Ted, but I think that heterotomy is plagued by a desire to be helpful, but oftentimes unwilling to do the work so that help is indeed forthcoming.
Yes, and Chip has a question.
Yes.
You had mentioned early on that the pandemic, people say that maybe brought out that there's more grief or more anxiety or depression or whatever. I guess my question is, when you look, is in fact this generation any different than any other generation? You look at World War I and things that people went through at that time. Do you sense that people are more depressed or more anxiety at this point than in the past? And also from an expectation perspective, it almost comes out that you're told you're supposed to be depressed, that give your feelings, but life is not perfect. You're going to face anxieties in life. Is there a danger of planting the seed that people can expect everything to be nirvana when in fact life is not nirvana?
Well, you just opened up for me maybe the theme we're going to develop when I come back in May to do a series. Let me deal with your first part of your question. I do suspicion and think a lot about the fact that perhaps our culture has changed significantly in terms of the kinds of structures, support mechanisms, and attitudes that we now embrace as over and against, as you say, other generations did not embrace. For example, Tom Brokaw's book, The Greatest Generation. I'm sure all of you have read that. And in that book, there's a marvelous sentence. He writes about the men and women who returned from the Second World War. And he writes that they came home. They went back to work. They paid their taxes. And they got on with life. And as I just the other day caught a news clip of a 101-year-old man who is a veteran of World War I. And the question was put to him, "Do you think of yourself as a hero?" His response was rather colorful, but also insightful. He said, "Hell no. I just did what I needed to do." So I do think that our culture today, in terms of, for example, the structure of our families, I think our culture today, our fascination with fantasy, I think our culture today with the belief that if we're on our phone, we're communicating, plus probably other issues that people far brighter than I are able to think about, I think that they have made us all more vulnerable to depression than perhaps other generations. Because Chip, you're absolutely right. Other generations faced, what would I call them? Social dilemmas that were every bit as serious as ours. There was a great flu epidemic back at the turn of the century. There was a world war at the turn of the century. How about the Great Depression at the turn of the century? And yet people find their way through that. So I do think that you're onto something when you suggest that indeed, perhaps our generation may be more vulnerable to depression. And perhaps that is linked to the second issue that you raise, and that is our level of expectation. You're so correct. Everything doesn't always go the way it's supposed to go. My dentist friend was not supposed to find a place in life where he saw no alternative but to kill himself. That wasn't supposed to happen. He was a man in his late 40s, early 50s, very successful, had three adopted kids, had a vibrant practice. That should not have happened. And, you know, on the tube this morning, what did we read about? 10 people dead in California who went to some sort of a dance studio to celebrate life. So that life happens. And sometimes our level of mythology is just so great that when it does, we can't handle it. Maybe you want to respond to that, Chip.
Now you've captured what I'm thinking about, that trying to put that in perspective. Again, I'm repeating myself, but you're going to face challenges, and how do you react to that? Is, I think, is part of the discussion here.
Yeah.
Anyone else online? Here, Jay has a comment question.
I'm just thinking back in my own challenges with death and change. I don't recognize going through some of those phases personally, and I wonder, coming out of it, how one would reflect back and say, well, I'm healthy in spite of not hitting all those tabs.
Yeah. Thanks for that, because I think that's a terribly important thing to say. And I would not dare speak for Ann Kubler-Ross, but I will anyway. I think she would agree totally with you. Nowhere does she suggest that any of those five stages is necessarily mandatory. Neither does she suggest that the positive effect that they have, ultimately yielding acceptance, are based upon some level of sequentiality that you went through 1, 2, 3, 4, and all. Look, you got to 5. And I would offer that perhaps that is so. In your case, you did not go through the various all of the stages, and that could have to do with where you were whenever you went through the experience of dealing with death and loss and change. And I'm just not talking about the point of view of chronology. I'm talking about maturity, exposure, having access to, I guess, friends or faith or family that enabled you to, your word is so well chosen, to be healthy as you walk through the reality of death, dying, grieving, and loss. I sometimes think that we make a mistake by believing that we're all the same whenever we experience a given moment. You know, that we are all the same when we become parents. We're all the same when we become a spouse. We're all the same when we deal with death. And that just isn't true. We are all on a spectrum. I'm learning that from friends who deal with autism. It's not been that long ago when autism was perceived in this singular foci of symptoms. And we've now discovered that isn't true. Sure, there's the autistic child who is cannot comfort them. They will not speak. They will not allow you to touch them. They are out there. You also have people who are on the spectrum who are contributing members of the society. I think we're the same way when it comes to death and dying.
Thank you. I don't see another hand, and I do hear the bell calling us to the sanctuary.
Okay.
So this has been wonderful.
As I said, Ted, next time I'm going to use three stories to talk about some of the things that I think the questions have raised today. So I look forward to being with you again next week. And thanks for the invitation today. It's always a joy to interact with you guys. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Take care.